When the clock strikes midnight, Pennsylvania's $31 billion spending bill becomes law. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As for the funding to pay for the spending plan, well, let's take that up with John Micek, editorial and opinions editor for PennLive.com. John, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Dave, how are you?
Well, this last-minute wrangling was indeed to come up with the ways to fund the $31 billion plan. Will that happen by midnight?
Nope. It doesn't look like there's a deal in sight. You know, hope springs eternal, of course, but it looks like everyone's kind of preparing themselves for the eventuality that there may not be a spending plan to go with this at 12:01 a.m.
John, I thought there was this quaint notion that the funding for the spending plan had to be in place as a prerequisite to having it go into effect.
Yeah, you'd think that would be the case. The state constitution actually calls for a balanced budget, but lawmakers in the administration are taking dramatically different views of that. The governor arguing that Article 4, Section 15 of the state constitution does not, quote, require him to sign, fully or partially veto the general appropriations bill. That's the spending bill that may lapse into law come midnight tonight. So therefore, it's okay because it's up to the General Assembly, under Article 8, Section 13, to ensure that the revenues are there to spend. The General Assembly, meanwhile, points to something called the Pennsylvania Administrative Code, which is like this double white pages sized book of rules and stuff that says, hey, you know what, there actually has to be a budget with money and numbers attached to it for it to be constitutional. So they're coming at it from two different areas of interpretation, which just sounds like a nightmare scenario, really.
And in fact, if one of those interpretations turns out to be the correct one, this could set a precedent for years to come. You could put any number on the map and then dilly and dally about it later.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope that it doesn't come to that. I hope that, you know, that by midnight tonight, cooler heads will prevail and there will be a revenue plan in place. Otherwise, you know, I mean, there could be conceivably a court fight over this to force the governor to bring to whip out his veto pen and bring the budget back into balance while they struggle to find, the money to pay for the whole thing.
John, there were certainly several potential revenue sources on the table. Are any of them gaining particular favor at this late hour?
Yeah, it's the ones that we've been hearing about all along, Dave. It's expanded gambling through legalization of what they're calling iGames, internet gaming. There's the revenue realized from so-called wine privatization. There was a bubble a little bit last week on whether or not they would tax cigars, which have hitherto avoided any sort of taxation at all, but they are looking at expanded taxes on other smokeless tobacco products and e-cigarettes. So it's the usual mix, but no dark horse favorites have emerged quite yet.
And that this is an election year, is that why on the surface lawmakers seem to be playing nice this time around?
Well, you know, you'd think so. I mean, from the administration's vantage point, they don't want the state tied up in bureaucratic knots with the world and her mistress about to descend on Philadelphia in 2 weeks' time for the Democratic National Convention. Republicans want the least number of impediments during campaign season. But, I mean, look, to be honest, these guys have, like, almost zero opposition in the general election campaign. I think everyone's just kind of suffering sort of budgetary PTSD, and no one wants to be hanging out here all summer working on another budget.
But that clock is ticking, so we have two and only two options. It will be funded or not, and it's going to be a strange new world if it's not funded.
Tomorrow morning, Tuesday, should be fascinating.
We'll have to call you back for a recap.
Absolutely.
John Micek, editorial and opinions editor for PennLive.com. New Jersey towns are getting some guidance from state courts over how to calculate their affordable housing obligations. Though advocates for the poor are not happy with the most recent ruling, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez explains.
From 1999 to 2015, 16 years, the state agency that was supposed to tell towns how much affordable housing to zone for wasn't doing it. Now the system is operating again, with regional courts approving towns' affordable housing plans. But nobody has really said whether towns would have to account for those lost 16 years. Now a state appeals court panel is saying no. Towns are not responsible for zoning for obligations from that so-called gap period.
We kind of view this as a puzzle. And now it's clear from the appellate panel that that piece doesn't fit in this puzzle.
Mike Serra is the assistant director of the New Jersey League of Municipalities. He says towns will still have to have their affordable housing plans approved by local courts.
But the end result will be that those obligations will likely be far more, you know, reasonable and rational.
The courts did say, however, that if substandard or overcrowded households arose during the gap period, towns would have to account for those in their plans. In a statement, the Fair Share Housing Center, a Cherry Hill-based nonprofit, says the ruling, quote, plays into the hands of wealthy towns. It also says the ruling ignores the needs of low-income families affected by the recession, foreclosure crisis, and casino closures that occurred during the gap period. This week's ruling will likely be appealed to the state Supreme Court. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
It's been well documented that in the American healthcare system, the cost for procedures varies widely. By way of example, a new study finds that the Philadelphia region is the fourth most expensive in the country for delivering a baby, nearly twice the price of Pittsburgh. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports.
It's not easy to give birth. And in the Philadelphia region, it's not cheap either. The healthcare company Castlight recently compared medical data across the country's 30 largest metropolitan areas. Sacramento topped the list at $15,400 for a routine delivery, while Philly came in at $11,300, the highest price on the East Coast. And if you're thinking, well, you pay more, you get better care, Kristen Torres-Moet with Castlight says that's not what's happening here.
There isn't rhyme or reason between quality and cost, which study after study has highlighted in healthcare.
So if it's not quality, what's driving the higher prices? It's likely a couple of things, according to Scott Lorch. He's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania.
There's a relatively less competitive marketplace. I think that the Philadelphia obstetric market over the last 15 years has shrunk considerably.
There used to be 19 obstetric facilities in Philadelphia. Today, there are 6. But it isn't just simple supply and demand. Prices can be influenced by the prevailing wages in a region and the number of big hospitals and insurance companies. Castlight's report doesn't include any theories, and it doesn't release its raw data, so it's hard to know how many procedures were considered in the study. But Dr. Lorch says this is a good reminder that if you can shop around, you probably should.
I think in the era where patients are taking a greater share of the costs of care, people have begun, when possible, to do more comparison shopping.
Of course, trying to get a healthcare price over the phone can feel a little bit like labor, too. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
A new exhibition that explores American politics through art is stirring some emotions for its whimsy and richness of works ranging from the 1800s to today. The Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts has assembled paintings, graphic art, cartoons, even papier-mâché gigantic sculptures to tell the story of America's democracy through the eyes of its artists. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez-Luna reports.
In some political speeches, words don't exactly flow, well, like pearls of wisdom, to use a cliché. So to illustrate George Washington's discomfort with public speaking, contemporary artist Brian Toll created a plexiglass bust of the first president.
With all the words of his first inaugural address coming out of his head in beads that then cascade down onto the floor.
Fellow citizens of the Senate and the House, Representative
Anna Marley, curator of historic American art at PAFA, is one of the curators of the exhibition. She says she likes the juxtaposition of contemporary and traditional art throughout the show. In this room, dedicated to the cult of presidential personality, an abstract expressionist portrait of JFK by Elaine de Kooning stands next to Washington's early depictions by Rembrandt Peale, for instance. Washington is the predominant theme here. He is in bas-relief medallions reminiscent of Roman emperors, majestic paintings depicting him in full military regalia, and modest engravings.
George Washington is one of these universal, I think, positive symbols of the United States.
But not for everyone, says African-American Philadelphia artist Theodore Harris, whose polemic work is part of the exhibition.
I think of a person who was an oppressor. These people may have been so-called brilliant men, but at the cost of who? At the cost of our freedom, they could stay free. It's complex, and I think that art is the thing that to get to the bottom of that complexity.
In his collages, Harris plays with political imagery to express his take on American historic conflicts. Part of that complexity is explored in The Wall of Presidents, again dedicated not only to George Washington, but to Martha Washington, says Marley.
And I think that's really important because George and Martha were a pair. They were a political pair. And when they were here in Philadelphia, their parties, their household was known as the Republican Court. And she was Lady Washington. So she was not only our first lady, but she was this political powerhouse in Philadelphia.
Perhaps the most spectacular artwork in this exhibition is Red Groom's immense colorful papier-mâché sculpture of the first president, standing very tall, accompanied by a smaller but no less important Martha. She's depicted as the figurehead of a ship, holding a laurel leaf crown, pointing the way towards the future of the nascent republic. Behind Washington stands Jefferson, and near him, sitting in a printer's chair, Benjamin Franklin. They're all components of the much larger Philadelphia Cornucopia installation unveiled in 1982 for the city's tricentenary and later abandoned in a city hall basement.
So many of the pieces sort of decompose beyond recognition. And when Red Grooms built this piece, it wasn't necessarily built to withstand the ages. In conserving this piece, we had to recreate certain parts of the sculpture.
From the first step into the academy, you can feel a sense of respectful irreverence in the work selected to tell the uneasy story of where arts and politics intersect. Art of protest and dissent take a large part of the galleries at PAFA. Controversy and violence, war, immigration, workers' rights, the fight against AIDS, civil rights struggle, all part of American history, stand next to each other in an ongoing conversation. Not always an easy dialogue, says curator Anna Marley.
We were very trepidatious about this show when we started working on it, because there's a lot of political landmines, and we have a huge collection to work from. But I think as it came together, we got more and more excited about it.
The exhibition, Happiness, Liberty, Life, American Arts and Politics at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts is somewhat designed to attract visitors and participants to the Democratic National Convention, but stays open until September. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Still ahead, Jalene Fest starts today, celebrating the legacy of Jalene Ringel, who was an exceptionally tall comic actress.
She went for an audition and she came home and she was like, apparently I'm too tall for three tall women, you know? And she's like, people didn't know what to do with her. And so she was kind of like, well, hell, I know what to do with me.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Let the waxing moon be your guide to great night sky viewing this week. Derek, the moon's the first quarter this evening. Let's set our sights.
This is a great week for us to use the moon as a guide to seeing other objects in the sky. The moon will slip right past both Mars and Saturn. Mars, I think, may be not so much difficulty because it stands out so clear and its colors makes it stand out so much more. But Saturn can often be a challenge. Even though it's very large in size, its great distance makes it appear smaller in the sky and maybe harder to identify from other stars, besides the fact that it doesn't have twinkles. So on Friday, you can use the moon to identify Saturn's position easily. 9 p.m., you'll find Saturn below the moon. Can't miss it. So this week we'll have two opportunities to use the moon to identify planets in our solar system.
Well, now let's enlarge the conversation from the moon to the moons of our solar system.
Yes, indeed. You know, our solar system has an incredible variety of moons, everywhere from the two moons we find orbiting Mars to the unbelievable system of moons that's found surrounding Jupiter. Jupiter has 67 moons. In fact, it's kind of unusual for the Earth to have just one moon. Venus has no moon, Mercury has no moon, but all the other planets of our solar system have multiple moons. In fact, Pluto itself has, I think it's 5 moons, to that end this Wednesday night. Night skies at the observatory will give us an opportunity to not only see some of the bright planets of our solar system, but we'll also have an opportunity to look at some of the moons. And I'll be presenting about this great and wide variety of moons that we have in our solar system and what information they might have for us about how solar systems are formed or about the possibility of life right here in our own backyard.
And when we were talking up the Juno project last week, we noted that part of the process was to have that craft ultimately meet its demise on Jupiter, lest it potentially contaminate one of the moons that perhaps have life.
Yes, indeed. The moon Europa at Jupiter has an icy crust under which scientists have been able to identify a liquid water ocean. Now, in order for that ocean to be liquid, that means the temperature must be above freezing. We know already on Earth that there are environments here that are far worse than that, where we already find life. The deepest portions of our oceans here on this planet are dark, incredible pressure, and certainly near freezing, if not below freezing. And so we know that there's life there, so we might envision the possibility that life could exist at a place like that. So rather than contaminate that location, the Juno spacecraft will be plunged into Jupiter, where it will be completely annihilated, destroying any kind of hitchhikers that might be along from the planet Earth.
Derek, we've been able to identify thousands of planets outside of our solar system orbiting other stars. Have we been able to identify any moons outside of our solar system?
Actually, it's difficult enough to identify that there are just planets orbiting these other stars, but there's no reason that we couldn't anticipate the existence of moons orbiting some of those. I mean, we've been surprised by the presence of moons in places we never expected them to be. You know, planets can acquire satellites in a number of different ways. Either those satellites are part of the planetary construction process, or they are detritus from planetary collisions that have been caught in the gravitational field of planets.
Is ours homegrown or captured?
Ours is homegrown after a collision with another object about the size of Mars way back in the early history of our planet. And so it's an amalgam of not only what was originally here, but this other object as well. And so we have a great mixture of stuff in our own moon.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing.
A week-long festival of solo performance works opens today at Plays and Players Theater in Rittenhouse Square. Called Jolene Fest, it's named after the comic actress Jolene Ringel, who passed away 11 years ago. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that Ringel left a legacy for women performers.
Jolene Ringel was a 6'2" Amazon from hell whom all men desired. That's according to herself. A comedian and cabaret singer, she performed original shows in Philadelphia and Cape May.
I have never worked with anyone quite like her.
Owen Robbins often accompanied Ringel on piano.
But she was so smart with her music. Just, there was a very, very special something about her. It's kind of hard to quantify.
Another one of Ringel's frequent collaborators was Jennifer Childs, the director of 1812 Productions, who, by the way, is short. Between them, there's a foot and a half difference. So they were a natural comic pair.
You know, I remember she went for an audition and she came home and she was like, apparently I'm too tall for 3 tall women, you know? And she's like, people didn't know what to do with her. And so she was kind of like, well, hell, I know what to do with me. And she made these incredible cabarets.
In 2005, Ringel died of cancer. She was just 40 years old. Almost immediately, Childs created the Jolene Ringel Solo Performance Program, which helps women create solo work, both artistically and financially. After 10 years of quietly assisting shows find their feet, there is now enough material for a festival. Jolene Fest is a week of cabarets and solo works by artists who went through the program. One of them is Sarah Gafkin. 2 years ago, she was an artist in residence at the Ringel program, where she worked up a show about Ethel Merman.
It's such an inspiring idea to be able to create your own work and make something that is your gift to the world. somebody needed to see it. And I think that Jolene sort of had a knack for knowing what she needed to say to people at that time. And that's such a cool and inspiring thing.
Jolene Fest kicks off with a cabaret on Monday, which will feature actress Mary Martello and Jennifer Childs. They sing a duet Childs used to sing with Jolene Ringel.
Forget your trouble.
Happy.
Come on, get happy.
I'm here again.
Childs says Ringel was funny right to the end.
Even when she was very, very sick, she made relentless fun of me for crying. She's like, oh my God, I got your message, you're crying again. And I was like, I'm, you know, she just wanted me to bring music. She's like, we got to work on our show. We got to work on a show. And there was no room to talk about the fact that that show was probably not going to happen. And so in some ways, for me, the Jolene program is working on the show.
Child says the performances in Jolene Fest will be mostly comic, some laugh-out-loud funny, some poignant funny, and some, she says, will be ha-ha-ouch funny. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.